Thank you. What I want to talk about today are some general observations, I guess, about OSHA. What we're planning to do is talk some about OSHA, about other legal remedies for workers to improve conditions in the United States through the National Labor Relations Act that Nancy will be talking about, and doing some comparing and contrasting with Canada that Dorothy is going to talk about. Nancy and I both have the privilege of at least some knowledge of what's going on in Canada because our unions do represent members up there. There's nothing to disclose. I don't think I've got that thing, but I have no conflicts of interest. Okay, so what I want to do is some kind of general slides, and I almost put some into a lot of these because that's really what it is. These are some points related to various things that we'll talk about. And when we come to successes and things like that, they're not necessarily totally successes. They're pluses and minuses in that regard as well. But I think what was most important and why we've defended OSHA, and there have been times throughout its history, its 40-year history, that's come under great attack. There was a bill, the Schweiker bill, back in 1980 to basically eliminate OSHA. That's not currently on the table right now, outright eliminating the agency, but certainly a lot of moves to seriously curtail any ability they have to issue regulations. Funding is always an issue as well. But why is OSHA important? Because it set a national priority that we were going to address health and safety. Of course, it came after a significant mine disaster in Farmington, West Virginia, 1968, which helped pass the Mine Safety Act, and then OSHA a year later. That's the history that we face. After the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire 100 years ago, there were a lot of building code and fire safety laws that passed. It unfortunately seems to take that kind of disaster to prompt regulation. It's important because it declared that workers in the United States have a right to a safe and healthy workplace, free of things that could cause death or serious injury. And that's a very important principle. And as I said, it created a priority. I wish in all the time that, we talk about this frequently, coming to the Public Health Association convention, that unfortunately workplace health and safety is not seen the same way as sexually transmitted diseases or other infectious diseases, other maternal child care issues. It's a public health issue. Unfortunately, because it's wrapped up in the combat between labor and capital, it's not always seen that way, but we strongly feel that it is a public health issue. And the passage of OSHA declared that this is a public health problem that affects a lot of people in this country. At that time, more than 50,000 deaths per year. It's a significant public health problem that we need to address on a national level. It also provided a mechanism to inspect workplaces and to issue citations against employers. It established a process for setting up standards. That's been a very cumbersome process, but it did establish a process for new standards. It also created NIOSH, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, which is under a different agency. It was under Health and Human Services back at that point, whereas OSHA, of course, was under the Department of Labor. And I don't really have an item on NIOSH, but let me say that NIOSH has made very significant contributions to workplace health and safety in terms of the training of health professionals, health hazard evaluations that they did, particularly in the area of indoor air issues, and did a lot of work within our industry, the grocery industry, in terms of minimizing the level of cumulative trauma injuries among cashiers in grocery stores by making recommendations that were adopted by a number of stores to cut that down. So NIOSH has made some very important contributions. Okay, in terms of the widely known OSHA achievements, when OSHA was passed, there were 14 to 15,000 people who died on the job each year just in terms of the accidents, the immediate deaths. That figure is now below 5,000. Now, some of that obviously is attributable to the fact that we have more of a service economy now. We've lost a lot of the heavy manufacturing, chemical, and oil industry, steel in the United States. But OSHA laws have made a significant difference. And as David Michaels says, that OSHA regulations prevent jobs from killing workers. They're not job killers. We saved a lot of lives because of OSHA. OSHA has been successful in implementing some effective standards. Certainly the reduction in exposure levels permitted to asbestos, benzene, and a number of other, cotton dust is another example, I think, have been successful standards. The implementation of the bloodborne pathogen standard has resulted in a significant decrease in healthcare workers coming down with hepatitis B or HIV. So some of the standards have been extremely effective. This is a one that has its pluses and minuses. Through the years, through education programs, first the New Directions and now the Susan Harwood program, OSHA has provided support that has helped create, in some cases, union health and safety departments, help maintain them. Whether that's that a lot of good work has happened from those programs, other people can also look at that and say that that's allowed unions to decrease the amount of resources and commitment they put into health and safety, and that being not a positive factor. Their recent, in the last 2 years, have given, through the Susan Harwood program, significant grants to worker centers, faith-based groups that work especially with immigrant workers, and have made very positive outreach to communities and groups that, represent the, core of high-risk workers in the United States. And I think they've sustained, I mean, everybody knows about OSHA to a certain extent. And some of the surveys indicate that OSHA is not the most unpopular agency out there because people feel that workers shouldn't go to work and not come home healthy and in one piece. And they know OSHA is in the business of trying to help that. And, you know, I think the image of OSHA is a little more positive than, you might think, more positive than EPA and some other agencies, just because it meets a very basic need that people feel is very important, or at least it tries to meet that need. Okay, there are a lot of structural problems with OSHA. And I'd say that it really, one of the core ones is there's no real role for workers that's written into OSHA at all. It's employer-based, employer-oriented. The appeals process is such that, you know, unions and can enter into the discussion about abatement periods, but their powers are much more limited as compared to employers who can contest the citations that were made, how much the, penalties are for, and so forth. And when I said no elements to encourage preventive initiatives, Dorothy will talk some about Canadian law, and, you know, there it's not perfect in, the province of Ontario, but there are certain things that are written in to the law that are different than the United States, and I think they're very concrete examples of how the OSHA law would be better if it incorporated some of those. There are mandatory health and safety programs, depending on the size of the workplace. There are mandatory health and safety committees. They're supposed to be half workers and half management. Workers have a more usable ability to stop hazardous work when it comes up. Health and safety, there's a terminology in Canada of due diligence, and, you know, that's reflected in the law to a, certain degree compared to the United States. And it's very clear that the responsibility that workers are part with government and employers of active players in workplace health and safety, and that just doesn't really exist in the OSHA law at all. Part of the problem with the OSHA standard is that standards have been piecemeal. You know, chemical X, chemical Y, you go through a procedure to establish a lengthy procedure through OMB and, you know, public hearings and so forth. The attempts to have more broad-based generic standards have been unsuccessful to date. And there are a lot of standards that are important that don't exist. We don't have a standard on ergonomics. We don't have a standard on heat. We don't have a standard on indoor air because, you know, in part of this kind of piecemeal approach to standard setting. The fine and criminal penalty sanctions are incredibly low with OSHA compared to EPA and other agencies. You know, the countless example, disturbing a burrow in a national park is a much more serious offense than, you know, a willful violation under the OSHA law. And also very important is that the criminal penalties are limited at this point to a misdemeanor, not a felony charge in the case of a willful act by an employer that resulted in the death of a worker. Another shortcoming of the OSHA law is that millions of public employees are not covered. States have an option of developing their own state plan. There are some states that have done that, that cover public employees, but if there isn't a plan on that level, then there are a number of states, about half the states have their own plan, and a lot of public employees are not covered. And key elements of the nature of work are not addressed. And by this I mean what I think are significant health and safety problems related to staffing, related to design of work, the speed of work, the pace of work, the hours of work, scheduling, and so forth. These are very significant factors that impact on the health and safety of workers that are not ever within the scope of OSHA at this point. Okay, there have been, I think, a number of administrative obstacles to OSHA effectiveness through the years. First one is it's been underfunded and understaffed from the outset. At this point, varying state to state, you're looking at anywhere from maybe 70 to 120 years that would take for OSHA inspector to reach every workplace. The staff, the number of staff is actually less now than it was in 1980, and there are about two times more workplaces that OSHA is responsible for. So, significant understaffing issues have been, present, as I say, from the beginning. Outside of, I'd say, about 10 of the 40-year history of OSHA, the OSHA has been led by political appointees or others who are basically hostile on one level or another to the mission of OSHA. Certainly not open to greater worker participation in the process and initiating preventive initiatives. There is a lot of interference in the standard-making process. I mentioned Office of Management and Budget, Congress, of course. One example, the only time Congress to date has interacted with the regulatory process of actually removing a regulation was the ergonomic standard, which OSHA put forth in late 2000, and then in March of 2001, Congress repealed the ergonomic standard. Now it's the Small Business Administration also that's playing a very significant role in reviewing all proposed standards. There have been problems with the state programs. I mentioned about half of the states have their own programs. We're doing better in New York now with new leadership in New York, especially the offices in New York City have not done a good job at all through the years, especially around hazard communication, about prompt response and inclusion of workers and unions when they're conducting inspections, a whole number of issues. Nevada had very serious problems, and OSHA actually went in and finally took steps because the enforcement in Nevada was so poor. So this is a difficult issue for OSHA on the federal level to really monitor to make sure the state programs are what they're supposed to be, that is, providing at least as effective health and safety coverage as on the federal level. And again, kind of a lack of legal, this comes up with what I mentioned before, there are no felony sanctions. That's not an option. So in terms of those cases where there have been workplace fatalities, OSHA has had difficulty pursuing some of those because they, as far as the solicitor is concerned, well, it's a misdemeanor. They end up doing more with EPA and other agencies than they do with OSHA. There are a couple steps that have been taken under the current leadership at OSHA that I think should be continued. Record keeping is a really critical issue in terms of the underreporting of injuries. I think more needs to be done in the area of actually looking at the logs and looking at the possibility that right now people think that all the OSHA logs are submitted to OSHA. Very few of them are, and so this is not really a data source for how many people are injured on the job, nor is there enough surveillance of how accurate those records are. But more important is that the behavior-based safety programs that discourage reporting of injuries have not really been evaluated, and I think OSHA should take a serious look when dealing and being concerned about injury underreporting and record keeping, to take a look at whether these programs exist in these workplaces and what the impact is. They have moved somewhat in the direction of multi-site corporate hazard citation enforcement. What I mean by this is that if company X has a certain violation and that, you know, it's found in one of their facilities, and that if the same situation occurs at another one of their facilities, that they should be cited as a repeat violation, you know, serious or whatever the designation is, because these companies ought to be passing this information on, ought to be responsible. They have been warned about this condition. They have another plant with the same process, should not have the same citations, hazards. OSHA in the last couple of years has expanded their outreach to immigrant groups, targeting particularly Latino workers who are in some of the highest risk industries. I think this needs to continue. It really needs to be expanded. I mean, we were part of a meeting that they had in New York City and they got a good turnout, but, you know, sometimes it kind of stops there. They have a nice meeting and, you know, what happens after that? I mean, there has to be a commitment. Again, we get into the resources, but there has to be a commitment to keep these things going, to have more than a conference every year or whatever, but to really make it a priority to maintain contact with these groups and work with them actively. Look for the situations where these groups might be helpful in terms of translating, helping inspectors when they go to a work site where the workforce primarily doesn't speak Spanish, to help facilitate communication between the workers and the inspectors. And, you know, I think they should expand those alliances. OSHA under previous administrations are really big on these alliances, which are mostly all with trade agent industry groups. And I think they ought to, you know, formally make alliances with some of these community groups and continue to expand their work with them. Okay, we have obviously significant political challenges that we're facing right now that impact on the effectiveness of OSHA and the effectiveness of health and safety. High unemployment is one of the causes for injury unreporting. People are afraid of, you know, that they'll be rescheduled, discriminated against, and in some sense be laid off or just told to hit the road about complaining about health and safety. And employers are pretty ready to, you know, tell them it's my way or the highway. We have a manufactured debt crisis in terms of the predicament that was created by the too big to fail and the resulting political movement that deficits are the most important thing to deal with, and so we have to slash government spending, and so that means, you know, slashing funding for OSHA and other agencies. That's aggravated, of course, by the ease of global movement of capital and jobs, and a lot of job loss from free trade agreements and so forth. And we're in a situation now where, you know, some of these industries are doing very well, and it's very clear they're sitting on a lot of money. They're choosing not to invest it in the United States and keep it elsewhere. And as long as it's, you know, can produce a higher return elsewhere, that's not likely to change. We have a well-financed attack on regulations, a number of bills that are going to come up in the House probably after Thanksgiving, which would further create barriers to the implementation of regulations, not only for OSHA, but for other agencies as well. One of the other factors I think is a significant political challenge we face is that worker compensation programs throughout the United States have been under attack. What they cover, the process of how long people are entitled to benefits. I mean, this was a social contract that's about 100 years old. And the social contract was you can't sue your employer, but we'll set up a worker compensation system. It will provide wage replacement for you for as long as you're unable to work, and it will cover medical costs. There's been constant attack on that state by state. As I said, on the conditions that are covered, how long they're covered, administrative procedures, designed to speed cases along, which have pressured people to settle for much less than their injury demands. And so this is one of the factors, you know, very clearly within our union and other unions where people have some alternative to worker compensation, even if they have a work-related problem. They're often very likely not to claim it as work-related, to run it through regular insurance to their detriment in terms of long-term coverage, but simply because they know the case will be challenged either by the company or the insurance company or both, that they could be faced with a couple years of being in limbo, wage-wise and medical care-wise, and, you know, avoiding being contested in the worker compensation system means that a lot of those cases don't end up being reported. And another issue, of course, is the decline in union membership, and coupled with significant obstacles to organizing here in the United States, which have remained. A few other additional challenges that we have out there. Corporate greed. We had, and maybe this is a...
What?
Yeah. We had a strike situation last year in the state of New York. We had over 300 workers in our union who went out on strike against Mott's, where they make applesauce and apple juice as part of Dr. Pepper Snapple. And the folks who went out on strike were not political folks. They're from upstate New York, and a lot of them are Republicans. They've never really been politically active. But there was something very shocking to them about the attitude of this corporation that was making record profits, a corporation whose CEO had gotten a 40% increase over the last 2 years. And we prepared for negotiation, and you know they were very clear at the outset, well, this is our last offer. Our last offer is that we're going to cut wages by $3 an hour. They wanted to cut pensions, other benefits. They wanted to implement work rules where people could be reassigned from their job to a lower-paying job just on a day-by-day basis, a whole number of things. And they were very clear that they weren't going to negotiate about it. They said, you're in upstate New York. These folks make about $20 an hour. There's a lot of unemployment here. You're frankly overpaid. These whippersnapper lawyers who are coming in to negotiate told our folks, you're overpaid. We want to cut your wages by $3 an hour. Well, they had a surprise. They thought they could bring anybody in to run the plant. They couldn't. They had a lot of lost product. They got a corporate black eye from, you know, they had to cancel all their events because we organized, you know, pickets when they were marketing Dr. Pepper Snapple. But most importantly, they didn't expect that these workers were going to be as strong as they were. And there were 305 workers who went out, and at the end of the strike, after 117 days, 297 were still on strike. Well, there's no doubt that that, you know, contributed. They did we win the strike? In a lot of ways, we did, or what was clear is the management lost it. You know, everything that they tried to do in terms of cutting benefits, cutting the pension, cutting wages was defeated. And we had a second group earlier this year. We represent the folks at Macy's, Herald Square. 4,000 folks work there. And we were expecting tough negotiations again, and you know, Macy's was coming in saying that they were wanting to cut healthcare, they want to cut pension, this and that. And we said, well, you know, we're determined that our workers are going to get a decent contract here. And you know what happened upstate New York, I think that was mentioned once. Well, it turned out with a variety of pressure, with demonstrations and, you know, prior, we got a much better contract out of Macy's than we would have ever expected, and with, you know, wage increases and pension increases, you know, a very good contract. And so that's the kind of action I think, you know, sends a message to corporate greed, and we'll talk more about that. Other workplace challenges, this whole area, there's so much that impacts on workplace health and safety that is going on, the redesign, the re-engineering, the, you know, idea that we see a lot in retail and other industries too, that people are expected, you know, start out with Walmart and now we hear it from Macy's and other people. We want you on call all the time, whether you're going to work or not. we're not going to make you full-time. We want to make you something less than full-time, but we want you to be on call 7 days a week ready to work. So that, you know, the understaffing issue is, you know, critical. I mean, it's such an important health and safety issue, and so we're facing that. We have to confront that challenge. I mentioned epidemic of injury reporting, you know, coming from these behavior-based safety programs that encourage people, reward people, or punish people for reporting injuries are prevalent. All the problems with worker compensation. You have folks are feeling vulnerable in terms of their employment. You have immigrant workers who are concerned about being deported. Nobody wants to stand out and be noticed and put at risk. We have a need to rebuild our health and safety movement within unions. We need to commit more resources to health and safety. And we need to get active. We need to be really pushing this as a social issue, and we need to find younger people to take over, because a lot of us who have been doing this for a while are getting on in years. So let me just talk about a couple values. I mean, amidst the challenges, one of the things that I got out of We Are Wisconsin is that people took pride in the work that they do. I think too much we've been, you know, since World War II, there's, you know, been such a push. We're a consumer society, and people have, you know, tended to lose pride in what they do and the importance of what they do, whether it's manufacturing a product or providing service or whatever. And what I heard from a lot of the people who got involved in Wisconsin is, I'm a librarian and I'm proud of that. I'm a teacher and I'm proud of that. I'm a, you know, a garbage collector and I'm proud about what I do. I do something important. I deserve dignity. I deserve respect. So I think that's an important value to take forward, and a, you know, value that we can use to confront some of the corporate greed. And, you know, in the We Are the 99%, I think it's identifying the great inequity in income, and that is not based on who's worked harder or whatever, but it's been based on rules of the game that have been tailored to create that kind of inequity. Again, as I mentioned, I think people value health and safety a lot. This has been reflected in surveys of workers in general and those who are in unions. There was a union busting firm that did a survey. They wanted to know what things they had to be aware of in organizing drives that maybe, you know, they should be concerned about, and health and safety was at the top of the list, that the workers feel that in a union situation they have more health and safety protections, and that's one of the reasons why they join a union. And I think we need to state our case very clearly that workplace health and safety is a human right, just like dignity and respect on the job, quality health care, adequate retirement, and a safe and healthy workplace are human rights, and we need to carry that message forward.
Thank you.